my fellow Climate Warriors. This is Matt Myers, and welcome to another episode of Climatech Cocktails, where you grab a drink or two with best-in-class Climatech founders to learn from their life journeys, dive into bleeding-edge technologies, and have a laugh while we're at it. My guest today is Trevor Best, co-founder and CEO of Syzygy Plasmonics. You can find Syzygy Plasmonics on Twitter at SYZYGY Plasmonic. Syzygy Plasmonics is pioneering a new type of chemical reactor driven by light rather than heat, enabling the potential for dramatically more efficient chemical manufacturing. At the heart of the reactor is a photocatalyst built with nanotechnology invented at Rice University. The company has focused its first efforts on hydrogen production, but its reactor platform has shown the ability to produce other industrial gases and chemicals without the high carbon emissions and costs associated with typical production processes. The energy transition is here. The time is now. And Syzygy Plasmonics is a badass Texan startup moving the needle with light. Without further ado, enjoy the show. Trevor Best, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, Matt, it is fantastic to be here.
It's great to have you here. And so what are we drinking today?
Yeah, so I am actually drinking from a bottle of scotch that another startup founder gave me. You know, he found out that I liked scotch. I don't know if you know about Japanese whiskey, but the Japanese have mastered the art of whiskey making. And there's a lot of like really interesting things happening in the scotch and whiskey scene in Japan. And he gave this, it's called the Kuri. K-U-R-I, and it is, you know, made in a Japanese curry wood barrels. It's one of the most interesting whiskeys I've ever had. So it's very much a whiskey. It's got, you know, the whole like smoky kind of aftertaste, but it's also got this like floral aftertaste to it, almost like you're sipping rose water, but if it were a really well-made scotch.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting to me. The only Japanese whiskey that I've ever had is Hibiki, which I think is what everybody thinks about when they think of Japanese whiskey.
Yeah.
And that Bill Murray movie.
Lost in Translation.
Lost in Translation, which, by the way, I don't want to segue to your co-founder, but I just randomly came up with Bill Murray in my mind because of Japanese whiskey. And then I was asking your co-founder when he met you, and he said that you had a photo of Bill Murray on your desk pointing, saying, "You're awesome." He said he doesn't know if you recall this, but he walked up to your cube and he pointed at you and you said, "You're awesome." And that's how he introduced himself to you.
That is amazing. And so I wish you could see my lab right now, or in my office. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 pieces of art in my lab right now. And what this is very much something that is near and dear to my heart.
What kind of art do you have? What's in there?
My girlfriend is a illustrator, really good. Used to be the graphic designer for the Houston Astros, now does a lot of work for LinkedIn. But she used to take me to this convention called MondoCon. And it's put on by Alamo Drafthouse. Have you ever been to movies there? They'll make these movie posters. So you go to this MondoCon, which is all these like, you know, new movie posters that have been made, like really amazing artists. The artists will set up booths and sell their own personal work. So a lot of the artwork in my lab right now was bought at MondoCon.
Super cool. Where do they do this? This is an awesome thing.
Yeah, Austin, Texas. Like here, I'll grab one off the wall and show it to you.
Great. This is really helpful for people who are listening, and which therefore
okay, so we here shall is a picture of a Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton
cool. In
solid gold next to a human skeleton, and for some reason they are saying the word hydrogen to each other.
Which what we'll come to, that's very meaningful for you.
Yes, yes. And so I'm sure everybody listening is like, what is going on? But I have 12 things like this hanging in my office right now. So I absolutely remember Bill Murray. And you know what, Matt? You're awesome.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm blushing. Yeah. And in fact, I was thinking back to the first time that we met, and I know I brought up before because I like to be a little braggadocious, but it was the eCapital Summit back in, drumroll, 2019, where, you know, I launched this clean tech prize and you guys won it.
Yeah, we took one of the prizes, $100,000 from Capital Factory. That actually helped to, you know, light the fire. It was the spark that got our Series A round going. Yeah. And so it started there at that eCapital Summit and ended up with us raising a total of about $9.7 million.
Right. That was your Series A. How big was the Series B?
Series B, that was about a year ago. That was just under $24 million.
Right. So the rest is history. And you all are crushing it. And we'll get to the whole crushing it part and where things are going. But, you know, first, I actually want to take, well, a couple steps back, which is your childhood. So I don't know how old you are, but, you know, it's a few steps. Where'd you grow up?
So I was born and raised in Midland, Texas, way out in West Texas in the desert. I was born in 1985. You know, I have seen the boom and bust cycle of the oil patch out there. And energy is kind of just in my blood, probably in a very real way. But yeah, born and raised in Midland, Texas. At 18, I went to school at Texas Tech University. Got a triple major in business, decided that I did not get far enough out of the desert. And after college, I went to go teach English in China. China was a bit too far out of the desert. Came back a year later and started working for Baker Hughes in Oklahoma. And then after a few years, relocated here in Houston back in 2011.
Well, hold on. Let's go back to Midland, which actually, being a fellow Texan, I looked up, you know, the history of Midland, which was actually called Midway at a certain point because it is midway between El Paso and Fort Worth, Texas. And the most notable thing about Midland, Texas, outside of Laura Bush coming from Midland, Texas, is that oil was discovered there in 1923, which, hooray, we'll have the 100-year anniversary next year, you know, for the discovery of oil there, which people will recognize the word Permian Basin, which is really where Midland is. And so, like, you're not exaggerating when you say you grew up in, you know, the middle of oil country.
Yeah. So, yeah, Midland and the heart of the Permian Basin. The Permian Basin is the heart of oil production in the United States. It has been for, like you said, a century. And it's interesting coming from those roots and then deciding that you're going to spend your life trying to change everything.
Did that inspire you at all growing up in the heart of oil country in terms of what you do now?
Absolutely. So I've been around energy since I was a kid. You know, I remember growing up. My dad was a doctor, and so I wasn't directly in the energy industry whenever I was a kid, but all my friends' parents, you know, used to have to go out to the oil patch and go travel around the world to meet with different oil companies. You know, got like multiple friends whose parents are geologists who like understand all the formations below Midland. And whenever I go home to visit my parents, there's like drill rigs set up, you know, a couple blocks from their house, and you can hear them like working at night.
Yeah. Interesting enough, I don't know if you've gotten to know Itasha Cave at all. I just released her episode today. She grew up in Texas and also very close to or across from a chemical production facility. And that was also very inspirational for her, you know, to go do what she does today.
Yeah, and we do know Itasha. She's an amazing human being. You know, I love what they've been doing with 12. We share an investor through Evoke Innovations. Yeah. And so I actually got to meet Itasha back in, I want to say, late 2019, a little bit after EarthX. We went up to Canada. We got to visit like a Suncor production facility together.
Awesome. And I heard that you had interesting hairstyles growing up, like different colored, was it mohawks?
Oh my goodness. Okay, so I was not expecting these questions. I think, hey, congratulations. I think this is the first time that somebody's asked me this on a podcast. So
I try.
So heck yeah, let's go. So whenever I'm going to school at Texas Tech, I cut my hair into a mohawk. And it was like a pretty good sized mohawk. Like it stood up like, you know, 8 inches or so. And that's I dyed it bright blue.
Yeah. And okay. Yeah. So you know what? I'm also revealing this for the first time. I had a faux hawk. I call it a faux hawk because, you know, I'm Jewish. And so I couldn't grow my hair too long without it getting curly. So it's more like, you know, probably a 4-inch situation above my head. And I also dyed it blue. And I was in this, you know, band in LA playing the Whiskey and places like that. And
oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, so but it wasn't only blue. Somebody told me they were dyeing it red one time and they actually did flamenco pink. So I had a flamenco pink faux hawk for a short period of time as well.
Oh, that is awesome. I absolutely love it.
Great. Well, yeah, maybe we should go back to that. Do you think?
I'm down. Hey, whenever you're ready, cut it, send me a picture and I'll do it.
Really?
I promise to go into at least one investment pitch with it before I cut it off.
Actually, really? Are you sure?
If you do it, I'll go into my next board meeting with it.
Okay. You promise you will? Because if I did do that and then you did it, that'd be really disappointing. And we actually have audio. This is like a verbal agreement.
If I don't do it, you can shame me publicly. And if I do it, then we have to have like some kind of moment on social media or something.
Yeah, true, true. And may everybody in our lives forgive us.
Yes, I agree.
And also, we have more in common than I realize. On a Chinese note, Ganbei.
Oh, hey, Ganbei.
Yeah, I lived there for 6.5 years. I guess we should just break out the Baijiu.
Oh, really? Where in China were you?
I was in Shanghai and Beijing.
Nice, nice. I was in Qingdao.
Qingdao? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went to Qingdao a couple times. My favorite thing about it is you can literally walk around with beer in a bag.
Yeah, I know. I used to get a kick out of that. And like, you know, I always had trouble. Like, what do you do? You know, and so like whenever I'd buy beer in a bag, like you end up like poking a hole in it and like pouring it out into a cup. But like, do you just like see people walking around with like grocery bags full of beer?
I wasn't as classy, and my friends and I would literally poke a straw into the bag and then we would walk around. And for people who are judging right now, the thing is, this is out of a keg. And Qingdao actually has very good beer if you buy it and drink it in Qingdao. If you're buying like Qingdao beer, which is very popular across China, and you can find it in Chinese restaurants in the US, it tastes, please don't take this offensively, Chinese people, but it tastes like crap. And so, you know, it's kind of like, also don't taste offensively, it's like, you know, if you're drinking a Bud Light or something, right? It's not very good. But in Qingdao, if you're drinking Qingdao beer there, it's very good.
It's delicious. I think if it gets over here, like it's set in like a shipping container, right, and it's no longer the form it came out of the brewery as, but like in Qingdao, like I just remember it was amazing and you drink it every day, all the time. Good times.
Yeah, yeah, with the seafood, which they also have very good seafood. Now people know if they go to the northeast of China, they should probably go to Qingdao and get beer in a bag and walk to a seafood restaurant and have a great time. I also heard you had a very interesting experience in China at a hospital.
Oh, yeah. So I'm going to embellish this a little bit because, hey, why not? It is my final day in China and we're throwing me a going away party because I'm getting on a plane in 12 hours to come home.
Big bags of beer. Yeah.
Yeah. Lots of beer. And we're taking shots and we're playing pool and all the good stuff. And I'm like, man, my stomach hurts. Like, oh, well, you know, who cares? Like, we'll worry about it. And then an hour later, I'm like, man, my stomach really hurts. Then an hour later, I'm like laying on the couch and people are like, dude, are you okay? And an hour later, they're taking me to the hospital and I get to the hospital and they're like, hey, man, you got appendicitis.
And you're like, shit.
Yes. I don't think a single word can encapsulate how I felt at that moment better than
I could
that
have
word.
Been home in a, you know, a U.S. hospital. And here I am about to leave in China with, you know, appendicitis.
And there was like a whole ordeal at that first hospital. So I could not get surgery there. And so we had to go to a second hospital that was like out in the countryside. And so it was like a rural hospital in China. They took my appendix out. And not only that, I remember right before they knocked me out, and I didn't know how to say much. I just kept saying, Shema Shaho Nigewo Shui Jiao, which means like, when will you give me sleep? God, I hope that's what it means. It's been a while.
It does. Yeah, good job.
Yeah, like, so like, when are you going to give me sleep? And finally, they hold up this needle and they're like, sleep. And I'm like, oh, cool. And then they give me an epidural and I'm like, what? And then they're like, ha, 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 just kidding. Like, this one's sleep. And then they knocked me out. I woke up on the operating table and they were still operating on me. And if they hadn't given me an epidural, it would have been a really traumatic experience, but I couldn't feel anything. So we got done with the operation, and I used to smoke cigarettes back then. So I'm all like groggy. Doctor's like, you know, hey, can we do anything for you? And I'm like, yeah, I want a cigarette. And doctor freaking gave me a cigarette, and I light it up and I take a drag and I almost puke. And I'm like, oh God, I feel awful. And the doctor's like laughing at me. He's like, ah, you're a dumbass. You know, you still want a cigarette, dumbass? And I'm like, no, take it away. But I turned out fine.
No, wait. So he gave you a cigarette in the hospital?
In the hospital. Like, yeah. You could walk up and down the hospital, like, aisle smoking. And one thing, this was not the main hospital in Qingdao or Guangdao where I was. This was like a rural hospital. Like, it was kind of, it's an interesting experience. Like, what? Yeah. I don't think that would have flown in a normal hospital, but where we were was like cash up front,
Right. In a hongbao, like a red envelope, just some cash. And yeah, here's a carton of cigarettes, doc. So you take extra good care of me.
Pretty much.
Yeah. And he's just like, would you like some baijiu as well to go with that cigarette? Right. Like,
no. I think he knew that it would make me feel really bad.
Yeah.
Because I did not have that was around the time that I quit smoking. And so it probably had something to do with that because it made me feel really bad. And then I did not want one for like 2 weeks.
That's amazing. There you go. And then so you came back to the U.S. without an appendix. It's left in China, in Qingdao somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And came back to the U.S. and what was next?
Got a job at Baker Hughes. Baker, big energy company. Started working in Centralift, which is their artificial lift division, made electrical submersible pumps out of Claremore, Oklahoma. I was doing what we called critical well applications, which are like deep water Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, got involved in the project management group and like process improvement and implementation around how we deliver like ultra deep water R&D equipment.
Awesome. And so you were there for how long?
I was in Claremore, Oklahoma for 2.5 years. Wow. So from beginning of 2009 to middle of 2011.
Okay. But at Baker Hughes, you were there for a while, right?
Oh, yeah. I was there for like 9 years. And Baker is a fantastic company. You know, love them to death. A lot of the success that we have had at Syzygy is because I am using the tools that I learned how to use there. You know, like organizational arc, like I got involved in like Six Sigma black belt stuff. And so like learned all kinds of stuff about process improvements, you know, organizational architecture, how to run projects, how to create budgets, how to, you know, all those things that I use in my life now, I first cut my teeth on at Baker. Yeah. And a lot of the reason why our R&D development at Syzygy is going so well is because Suman and I got to cut our teeth on R&D and new product development at Baker. And we got to see like what things went well and what things didn't and apply those to our own organization.
Right. And so you mentioned that you had a few other startups before Syzygy. Was that while you were at Baker?
Yeah. So while I was at Baker, I was trying to start companies. The first three never really got off the ground. Before I wanted to take like the flying leap into the abyss, starting a startup. I wanted it to get, you know, enough wings underneath it to know that it wouldn't just crash and burn. And the first three never really met muster. Good ideas, but failed for different reasons.
What did they do? What was the product or the service?
So the first one was going to be a nonprofit called H2 Open Source. and we were going to be open sourcing solutions for third world water problems. Like basically like, hey, there's this village somewhere that needs like a new well drilled, you know, and we post like a call and then somebody could like sponsor, you know, some kind of solution to that. Like, oh, hey, we'll come drill a well, or I'll give the money if someone can come like. And so open source solutions, H2 open source, going to be a nonprofit. We selected the wrong team. And a lot of the people we worked on that with like were not really interested. They liked the idea of starting something, but whenever like rubber meets the road, no one was like showing up to the meetings or getting their work done on time. And we missed a couple key filing deadlines to go after some grants and other things. And ultimately like didn't have the right team and it fell apart.
That's a telling sign.
Yeah. The next one was a mobile fuel delivery app. So you like app on your phone, hit a button, it geofences where you're at, you leave your gas can open and our truck comes and fills your car with gas. I've actually seen a bunch of people try and start this startup and it always dies. And I know why, because I didn't build a financial model for the thing in the beginning. And we got to the point where we started pitching to people, you know, maybe trying to raise money, and a really prudent investor started really pressing us like on unit economics. How many cars do you have to sell, you know, deliver gas to make money? And we found that the thing really can't make money. You have to charge $20 on top of the price of gas to make it through the initial phases. And nobody would pay that kind of money. And whenever we started really digging into the financial model, we're like, oh man, this can't work. So we gave up on that one. And then the next one was the first one with Sumon, and that was around water purification. And that was called Matabios, which is, I think, Latin or something for like kill life, which maybe wasn't the best name, but it was we were going to make a water bottle and you fill it with this silane coating. And silanes are these interesting molecules. They use them to fog operating rooms with. And they have a really interesting physical structure that will physically shred bacteria and virus. And so you basically cover the inside of a water bottle with this coating and then you could just like shake it. And it would physically shred all the bacteria and virus in the water and make it safe to drink. And we built a prototype and we achieved like a 99% kill in one of our first tests. And we get super excited. We were like, oh man, this is going to be big. And then we find out the people that we're buying this coating from definitely don't have the rights to sell it. They're like getting it underhand from China. And we find out the BASF and Dow are like suing each other over who owns these molecules. And we're like, oh man, if we bring this to market, we're going to get crushed. Like, you know, so we get to
it's great though. I love to hear that. Right? Yeah. It's just, you know, you're trying out all different things and it's important when you fail to smile and learn and move on.
Yeah. So we get to Syzygy. What we decide to do is create a framework and we start looking for a new technology. The framework, we called it TMI, which was technology, market, and impact. We'd assess the technology, make sure that it is free and clear, nobody's suing each other, you know, it's patentable, make sure that the inventors are credible and it is like published in, you know, credible academic journals, et cetera. So make sure the technology is good, market, build the financial model, make sure the thing can make money, call customers, make sure that if you build this, people will buy it. You know, vet all the market sides of it, and then impact, like if you do this, will it actually like cause a positive impact on the world? Like, can we, you know, prevent emissions? Does it help human health, et cetera? And we just started putting different technologies through that framework with the goal of killing them as fast as possible.
Yeah.
And if you can kill it, then you should definitely go do something else. Yeah. The when we found the Syzygy photocatalyst, like it would not die. There is nothing that we could throw at it that made it look less exciting.
How did you find it?
I mean, we were doing a tech search. We were looking at all kinds of papers coming out from different universities. We were looking at stuff coming out of MIT, Stanford, of course, paying attention to Houston, U of H. My co-founder, Sumon, he went to Rice University. So we're watching Rice very closely. And in August of 2016, the first antenna reactor photocatalyst paper was published by Rice. And the rest is history.
Yeah, yeah. And how long did this take, this process?
H2 open source was 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Fueler, the mobile fuel delivery app, was 2014 into early 2015. Matabios was 2015 into early 2016. And then probably around February or March, we started the search for a new tech. February, March 2016, started the search for a new tech. We would go through like a couple ideas a week. Like we were looking at stuff like solar thermal, like the Ivanpah solar plant, like stuff like what Heliogen's doing now and, and some others. We were looking at, like, I love Gravity Battery, which like Energy Vault is doing that. Oh man, Gravity Battery was my jam, but I couldn't make it past some of the economics hurdles. I'm sure Energy Vault has found a way around some. You know, all kinds of stuff. We found a really interesting alloy. It was a titanium gold alloy that could be used to make implants. And right now, if you get like a shoulder implant, it will erode over like 10 years. And after like a decade or 15 years, you have to get it replaced. Well, if you made them out of this titanium gold alloy, because it had such crazy wear resistance profiles, you would never need to get it replaced. But I think Johnson & Johnson like snagged that one. You know, we're like, hey, Rice, do you want to give that one to two like little aspiring entrepreneurs, or do you want to give it to Johnson & Johnson? And
yeah, so easy, quick decision.
You know, then in August 2016 was when we first found this paper and we started doing diligence on it. And we would meet with the professors about once a week. You know, every Wednesday night at 7 p.m., we'd meet with the professors and just ask them questions about the tech. You know, like, what does it cost to make? How do you scale it up? What are the metrics? What are the... And we're like, okay, let's compare it to previous photocatalysts. It's like, okay, this is 1,000 times better. Wow, that's exciting. How much does it cost to make? Oh, it's super cheap to make. It's actually cheaper than regular catalyst to make. Okay, that's encouraging. We build a reactor out of it. What does that look like? Well, reactor, you know, doesn't need combustion. It's very low temperature. You can build that reactor out of aluminum. So it's dirt cheap to build. Like, wow, that's interesting. Let's call customers. Would you buy this? Everyone's saying yes. You know, so it just kept clearing all the hurdles. We couldn't find a reason why it wouldn't work. And so our first pitch to investors was, we can't see a reason why this won't work. Please give us money.
That's great. What a great pitch. The end, right? That's like slide. It was like three slides, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah. That's great. And so what is a photocatalyst?
So a photocatalyst, well, first off, let's talk about what a catalyst is. A catalyst is a material that helps chemical reactions happen. And so when you think about like a refinery or a chemical plant, and these are the things that make like fuel and fertilizer and raw materials for plastics, they use catalysts in the presence of energy to do chemical reactions and make these products. So a traditional catalyst uses thermal energy. And so that is heat, the heat and pressure that generally comes from burning fuel. An electrocatalyst, like what 12 and Atosha is working on, an electrocatalyst uses electricity and an electrode, and a photocatalyst uses light. And so, yeah, we are using photons of light to perform chemical reactions. And so the photons, you know, photo plus the catalyst gives you photocatalyst.
And let's talk about photons. And I'm going to pour myself a little bit, a second drink while you talk about photons.
Okay. Hey, don't worry. This is how most people respond to the, all right, let's talk about photons. And everyone's like, hold on, can I please get another drink before we start this section?
Yeah, because before this, I Googled, hey, what is a photon? And I shouldn't, like, come on. It's like, Matt, you should know all these things, right? Come, I'm being honest. I don't. So I was like, okay, what's a photon? And then I'm digging into Einstein and physics. And I'm like, awesome. Let's talk to you about what a photon is, just now that you've been drinking a little bit. It'll make it easier. It's kind of like learning Chinese, right? Or speaking Chinese, actually. It's like speaking Chinese. You know, it's like if you've had a drink or two, like the Chinese is so much easier to speak than if you have.
Very true. Can confirm. Yeah. So a photon is a quasi particle. And we could, depending on how deep down the rabbit hole we want to go, there's a whole like, is it a wave? Is it a particle?
No, let's go a little bit. Let's go a little bit. I was looking, is it a wave? Is it a particle? It's both.
Yes, pretty much. And basically, it's a unit of electromagnetic radiation. You know, electromagnetic radiation, you know, one of the four forces, presents itself as photons of light. And so, like, really, if you think about, like, what is coming out of the sun, you think about what a photon is, it doesn't necessarily have, like, a discrete beginning and end like a particle does. You know, it's kind of like a beam or a wave. Mm-hmm. You know, but to help people think about it, you can split it up into like functional units. And this is like what a quasi-particle is. So like a photon at a given wavelength has a certain amount of energy. We would need to go way down the physics rabbit hole. And we probably, after a few more drinks, we definitely need to call my co-founder, Suman, to come in here and talk about this stuff.
Okay, another question. And then I swear I'll stop quizzing you on photons because I find it interesting. And I think it's really important, obviously, to everything that you all do. But how are photons formed?
That is a pretty complex question. In general, we as humans experience photons in two forms. One is natural light and the other I'm going to call artificial light. And so natural light, you know, coming from the sun. And basically, there is this huge fusion reactor, you know, in the sky, and it is just, you know, through the fusion reaction producing tons and tons and tons of energy. And as the energy is escaping that system, a lot of that energy is escaping in the form of photons, light. And so it is basically like, you know, the sun giving off energy in the form of magnetic radiation, photons that we experience as light. Now, the other version of this is, you know, artificial light. And this can come into a lot of different, you know, LEDs, incandescent bulbs, etc. But through, I'm going to have some scientists like assault me after I say what I'm about to say. But through a relatively similar process.
This is Clement Tech Cocktails, okay?
Yeah,
this isn't,
yeah.
This isn't the science journal.
Yeah. Okay. So when you apply energy to certain materials,
yeah,
they give off that energy. You know, like you put energy through certain material. Like think about an incandescent bulb. You have this little metal filament and you put electricity, you put energy through it. It will then release some of that energy in the form of light.
Right.
You know, some comes out as heat, you know, some comes out as light.
Right. And I'm just doing this to share with everybody because they can go on Google. Maybe I just want to sound smart, but I think a photon is technically formed by an electron. So electrons like go in orbits, right, around a nucleus. And so when electron might jump from one orbit to another. And then, but it wants to go home to its natural orbit. So when it goes back to its natural orbit, it'll release a packet of energy, which is a photon. So some scientists are going to massacre me too, because I.
Yeah, you're actually not far off. Like that's good enough for what we're doing right now.
Great. Okay, and so then how does that apply to what you all have built?
Okay, so
like, how does it work?
Okay, so that photon is energy.
Yeah.
You know, and so what we're doing is our catalyst is catching that energy in that light. And then we're actually doing the reverse of what you were saying, where you're having like an electron like lose energy and it's sending it out as a photon. We are grabbing that photon and putting that, using our catalyst to put that energy into an electron so that electron can then go do work. So it can like make or break chemical bonds. Mm-hmm. And so our catalyst is catching photons and then using them to make chemical reactions happen, to rearrange molecules into a new structure, and that new structure being something that is like fuel or a base for plastic or hydrogen, which everyone's super excited about, etc.
And this is all being done within a reactor.
Cool. Correct. Yeah. And our reactor is like a chamber that holds our catalyst and gives the catalyst the conditions it needs to make chemical reactions happen. So you're feeding in some kind of feedstock. You're feeding in one type of molecule, and then you're reacting it. You're changing up its configuration to turn it into a different type of molecule.
Right. And that's happening within a within the chamber, and you have the right, correct? Or chamber's producing, right? And the chamber's producing. Look, this is really complicated, y'all. So I feel like I'm doing a half decent job of trying to explain this, but it's happening within a chamber, and then basically you're using LED lights to capture photons, which are then powering this process, right? Is that
so? The LEDs are not capturing the photons. The catalyst is capturing the photons.
Right.
So
okay.
Yeah, we are. So if you wanted to imagine our reactor, we have an aluminum shell, and so like imagine a tube, and on the inside of the tube we have LED lights all packing the entire inside diameter of the tube. Then inside, just inside that, we have another glass tube, and that glass tube holds our catalyst. You know, our catalyst looks kind of like black beach sand, like volcanic sand or something. And so then we turn those LEDs on, you know, so they're powered by renewable electricity. We turn those LEDs on, they emit tons of photons, and those photons then pass through the glass and they illuminate our catalyst. So all that light is then hitting this black sand type catalyst, and then we flow the feedstock through. And so, you know, the feedstock flows through the sand. It's some kind of gaseous feedstock. You know, we can, like, for example, we can make hydrogen from ammonia. So we would flow ammonia in, and then it would interact with the catalyst in the presence of that light, and it would split it and turn it into hydrogen and nitrogen.
Hmm.
And some interesting things about this, because we aren't burning fuel, because a traditional reactor, you're burning tons of fuel, there's lots of heat and pressure, that that metal tube that the LEDs are on, it's actually made from aluminum. So it's super cheap. You know, LEDs, mass manufactured, not super expensive. That glass tube, glass, super cheap. All the components here, very low cost. And what is really cool, and since we're drinking, I'll let you in on a little secret. those LEDs are hyper efficient now. We now have like incredibly high efficiency LEDs. And the reason is the marijuana industry pushed the LED industry to make super efficient LEDs as grow lights, because it would reduce their warehousing costs to grow pot inside.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that those ultra high efficiency LEDs work perfect in our reactor. So grow lights plus Syzygy catalyst results in something completely new.
Yeah, just go tell the weed guys that, and they'll be like, see, we're saving the planet.
Actually, I imagine they'd say something like, what? But, nah, man, they would probably be super jazzed.
Right, yeah. And so why is this important environmentally? You touched upon it because what the alternative is. But if you can get a bit more explanatory of why it's so important, and maybe a few metrics as well to wrap our heads around.
Yeah. So I want everybody to imagine something in their head. If you've ever driven by a refinery, if you're ever in Houston and you drive through Baytown, you'll know what I'm talking about. A refinery, a chemical plant, and you see these massive structures and you see all these smokestacks everywhere. And the reason for a lot of those smokestacks is because these chemical processes are powered by combustion. So somewhere deep in the heart of that beast, there is a chemical reactor with lots of burners that is burning just tremendous amounts of natural gas or naphtha or something else to produce heat to make those chemical reactions happen. So our reactor, powered by LEDs, does not need combustion. So we are able to power our reactor with renewable electricity. So instead of the heart of that refinery being, you know, something that's burning a lot of fuel, it changes it to something that's running on renewable electricity. So if you were to drive by a refinery that was using our technology, there would be no smokestacks. There would be no like giant emission cloud coming up above it. We don't need to burn fuel. We don't need to produce emissions. And so if you think about the global chemical value chain that makes fuel, that makes fertilizer, that makes all these different things, they produce about a gigaton of CO2 every single year just through the combustion to power the processes. And so if, you know, all technology in the world were to, you know, all chemical tech were to switch over to what we're doing tomorrow, it would prevent about a gigaton of CO2 every single year. And that ultimately is like why this matters. Beyond that, you know, some other important metrics is cost. when we talk about fuel, when we talk about fertilizer, we also probably don't want to talk about what happens to the planet if the price of fertilizer goes up 5x. People got to eat, you know, people have to get to work, people have to, you know, products have to travel around the world. Fuel, you know, raw materials for plastic, ammonia, methanol, these really base chemicals. Without them, planet Earth doesn't function, and they are ultra commodities. The economy can't take like wild swings in price. So making, not only eliminating their emissions, but making them really low cost is very important. So the fact that we can use low cost renewable electricity, the fact that we can build our reactor out of aluminum, the fact that the hyper efficient lights result in a hyper efficient reactor, these are all incredibly important things so that we can make products at price parity with us, with what's out there today, without, you know, producing those emissions. And ultimately, that's the goal of the company.
So it's potentially cleaner and cheaper.
Bingo. You got it.
Bam. Hashtag cleaner is cheaper.
Yeah. And we're going to find that to be true over time. You know, not just Syzygy, but planet Earth as a whole.
Absolutely. And so what are the applications for this? It's you mentioned ammonia and hydrogen, but what are, you know, potential feedstocks? What are also potential products or particles that are coming out on the other side?
Yeah. So before I get into feedstocks and the precise reactions we're doing, it's good to just kind of take a step back and look at like our photocatalyst platform. Our photocatalyst platform is highly adaptable to do different things. We have done more than a dozen different chemical reactions. We have like papers, you know, multiple papers in Nature, multiple papers in Science, and all of these are doing different chemical reactions, which is super interesting. So we are not a one-trick pony. We don't just have like one thing we can do, and if it doesn't work, you know, we're toast. We can maneuver and adapt the tech in very interesting ways. So there's three big reactions that we're taking to market now, and then there's a couple that are going to follow later. And so I'm going to split these apart. The three that are ready and we're starting to go to market with today are zero emission hydrogen, CO2 utilization, which we're calling CO2 to X, and we'll talk a little bit about that one, and then finally, low emission hydrogen. And each one of them plays like a different role in the ecosystem. So let's start with zero emission hydrogen. The specific reaction is ammonia splitting. So this is ammonia NH3, and you are splitting it to get nitrogen and hydrogen. And you would do this if you are an energy importing nation and you need to import your energy and you no longer want to import like liquid natural gas, LNG, you know, that has a pesky carbon atom attached to it. So if you want to burn it or get the hydrogen out, you still have to deal with that carbon atom. If you use ammonia as a hydrogen carrier, the only other byproduct is nitrogen. So
this might be good for the EU right now.
We're talking to a lot of people in the EU. They're very interested. They're probably going to import about half of their hydrogen demand is going to be imported, and it is looking like ammonia is going to be the carrier of choice. So tons of interest from the EU. Also, Japan and Korea, tons and tons of interest for those. So if you're an energy importer, you're going to be bringing in ammonia, and a good chunk of that ammonia, you're going to split to get the hydrogen back out. And our reactor is perfect for that. And because ammonia has no carbon atom, you know, when you're driving all this with renewable electricity, it is ultimately zero carbon. About 7 out of every 10 calls that Syzygy gets is on that reaction right there. The next reaction is a CO2 to X. And so this is a reaction called dry reforming, where we are combining CO2 plus methane, CH4, to make syngas. So these are the two most potent greenhouse gases, combining them together to make syngas. Once you have syngas, you can then go to methanol, or through Fischer-Tropsch, you can go to like syn fuels or sustainable aviation fuel, etc. What's interesting is, you know, depending on your sources, this has the potential to be the most carbon negative reaction possible. So if you're taking in like methane that would otherwise go into the atmosphere, and you're taking in CO2 either from the atmosphere or from an industrial process and keeping it from going into the atmosphere, this has the potential to be the most carbon negative reaction that you can do.
Right.
And ultimately turn it into either a sustainable fuel or turn it into methanol. And once you have methanol, you can go to a bunch of other different things.
Okay. I have a question. What is the difference between, what would you say, zero carbon hydrogen, like, you know,
zero emission hydrogen,
and then low, or zero emission hydrogen and then low emission hydrogen? Like, what's the difference?
The first reaction is the reaction we're doing. And so that first one, using ammonia, there is no carbon atom, you know, potential for it to be like zero, especially like at our equipment level. Like, there are no notable, you know, emissions from the equipment. Yeah. So for low carbon hydrogen, we're doing a different reaction. And that's the third reaction we're bringing to market. And so that one is photocatalytic steam reforming. So the vast majority of Earth's hydrogen today is made through a process of steam methane reforming, SMR. When you're doing this, you're making emissions from two sources. One is you're, you know, burning a lot of fuel to power the process. That's that emissions from combustion we were talking about. And the other is because methane has a carbon atom attached to it. So when we do our photocatalytic SMR, we eliminate all those emissions from combustion. Mm-hmm. That's about 40% of the total emissions, and they're just gone. You still do have CO2 right. that comes from using methane, but then that CO2 is much easier to capture and sequester. So CCUS is going to be much easier than with like a traditional SMR. If the planet doesn't want to like completely shutter and like turn off all their SMRs in the next like year, in the next couple of years, and they want to transition them to low emission options. So if you've already got a refinery running right. and you're not just going to shut the thing down, but you want to reduce its emissions, this is a really fantastic way to retrofit and start to make it easier to, you know, do CCUS and bring that to like as ultimately like a very, very low carbon refinery. It's a really strong pathway for doing that. And so it's like, that one's kind of like the bridge. The zero emission is the long-term future. And then the low emission is like the bridge to the future.
Right. So can I ask you an honest question about hydrogen?
Yes.
So I'd say like maybe a decade ago, hydrogen being a real substantial fuel source was a pipe dream. And then, like, I'd say probably 5 to 6 years ago, it was the crazies, right? Like, every hydrogen person I met, I'm just being honest, they're pretty wacko. Like, they're pretty crazy people. And it was like, nah, this isn't really going to happen. And then fast forward to, it seems like during the, you know, earlier days of the pandemic, or kind of like, you know, the climate tech craze, hydrogen has gotten a lot of attention, a lot of money flowing into it. And so it's gone from like a pipe dream to a crazy idea to let's throw a bunch of money at it. And I feel like we're still at that, you know, that phase of let's throw a bunch of money at it. So what's the honest assessment? Me, my two cents, not that it matters to anybody, is like, it's still probably a crazy idea, bordering on possible idea. And it's like all the money will help it become a possible idea. And it's still just going to take longer than people would hope, you know, like maybe it might be another 5 to 10 years before we actually see like it really starting to be a decent size of the pie, like, you know, a small piece of the pie. And so anyways, that's my take on it. Anyways, I know it's kind of an odd question to ask you since your business is helping make hydrogen, but I'm just looking for like kind of an honest assessment. And I did watch your hydrogen podcast. Yes, I am one of 31 people who watch it on YouTube. And so I know that you are happy to talk about this subject matter as well.
Oh, absolutely. I'm like, oh God, Matt, I feel attacked. What am I going to say? I'm going to start off with the reality of the world, and then I'm going to talk about what scares the hell out of me.
Yeah.
And then I am going to talk about how to find real hope in the future.
I love it.
I know this is what you really wanted to know.
I love the narrative arc. Let's go for it.
So the reality of the world and our fight on climate change, I'm definitely not the only one who thinks this, is that there is no real way to truly decarbonize the planet where hydrogen plays no role. Mm-hmm. Hydrogen absolutely has a role to play. It has too many uses. It can be used for clean energy. You know, it can be used as an energy storage mechanism. It can be used as a feedstock to help split CO2 and turn it into other things. Mm. It has no carbon atom attached to it. It's one of the few chemical energy carriers that doesn't have, you know, a carbon atom attached to it. And the other being ammonia, you need hydrogen to make. I don't think there is a scenario where we truly decarbonize society where hydrogen doesn't play a big role. And this is why everybody's going crazy about it, because they see it. You know, if we actually accomplish all the, you know, 2050 goals, then hydrogen plays a big role. And that's where the hype's coming from. Now I'm going to tell you what scares me. What scares me is hyperbole in the market. Investors like to dramatically oversimplify things. And the energy infrastructure of our planet is a very, very complex organism. And right now, people want to pretend like planet Earth is a single use case. And so a lot of the money that you've seen thrown into hydrogen really supports like one pathway, which is water splitting, electrolysis. And this is, you know, water splitting is electrolysis, very, very old tech, first done 200 years ago. You know, they tried to make it work in the 70s. Bush tried to make it work in the 90s. They tried to make it work in the early 2000s. Here we are again. I think it can work in some scenarios. Takes a whole lot of electricity. And when electricity is like dirt cheap, you know, you can get that 1 cent solar, 2 cent wind, you can make electrolysis work. It scares me because everybody's going so big into it. They're going into it like it's going to work in 100% of scenarios everywhere.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I don't think that's the case. I don't think there is a silver bullet for this thing. I think that we need some silver buckshot. And I see a lot of other good pathways getting passed over because they don't quite have the brand recognition that green hydrogen has. And that scares me because I'm afraid that there's going to be a market correction when hydrogen can't live up to the promise of a couple big companies and what has been touted as, unless if we diversify. So now I'm going to get to real hope. And real hope comes in the form of carbon accounting. Different pathways have different carbon intensities. And even green hydrogen, for as great as it is, the carbon intensity can be pretty abysmal depending on like where you're getting your electricity from. And so like solar panels, wind farms, electricity from biomass, like all these have wildly different carbon intensities per the International Panel on Climate Change. And resulting hydrogen made from them has different carbon intensities. Some pathways like blue hydrogen, which a lot of people spit at me whenever I say, has carbon intensity better than green in a lot of scenarios. Some blue hydrogen pathways are so ugly and abysmal, we should never, ever touch them. You know, and we should disparage those people and put them out of business. But some blue hydrogen's not so bad. Some turquoise hydrogen's not so bad. Some green hydrogen's really good. We should support the pathways that actually decarbonize as opposed to the ones that just brand well.
Right.
And I think that I've seen in the past couple months, investors are starting to take a more diversified approach to it. And there's a lot, I'm not the only one talking about carbon intensity now. Even the, you know, Department of Energy and like the Build Back Better Act are talking about like hydrogen credits based off carbon intensity and not pathway. And so I think it's going to take us a while to get there. I think that there probably will be a market correction because certain pathways have been overhyped. But I do think long-term, people see the value in this and reason will take over. And towards the end of the decade, you're going to see a very diversified approach where you have a lot of different pathways getting to hydrogen. And we're picking the ones that make the most sense for given geographies and given scenarios. Sorry for that really long-winded answer. But
no, it's great. And is there a graphic for dummies for people to look at the different pathways and see what their different carbon intensities are, kind of like maybe McKinsey produced some, you know, very logical.
Why? Thank you for teeing me up for a perfect sell.
Wow, look at that.
Syzygy has actually put our techno-economic model and our carbon intensity model online, open access for the public. So you can access our, you know, techno-economic and carbon intensity model for hydrogen production. Looks at a lot of different pathways at www.carbonmodel.com.
There we go.
www.carbonmodel.com.
And for everybody listening, I did not purposely tee that up. That was totally by accident.
I'm just that good. Oh, God.
So speaking of hope, what does the next year or two look like for Syzygy if everything goes right and there's no problems?
I mean, there's always problems. There's always something, you know.
Sarcastically.
Yeah. So, you know, everything goes according to plan, which the past few years have taught us always happens. We start getting our product out of the market, being our reactors. We start deploying reactors at customer sites middle of next year. You know, so like middle to the end of next year, getting our first field trials up and running, you know, getting that first data from, you know, true customer operations. 2024, we start doing larger deployments, you know, reactor banks, which is many of our reactors working together to start to hit scale. 2025, you start to see us doing larger projects, like these start to turn into like real commercial projects that like produce pretty sizable amounts of hydrogen. Like we're actually like starting to, you know, supply amounts of product that are meaningful to like refineries and chemical plants. And then starting like 2026, 2027, we start like the mega projects.
Yeah.
And probably 2027 is the first, you know, once again, everything goes according to plan. 2027 is the first year that you see like a true mega deployment for our technology. Mm. And we realize our value proposition. And from 2027 onwards, this is like disruptive for energy and chemicals the way, you know, iPhone was disruptive to, you know, photography.
Right. Yeah. And I wish that more people could see in person what this reactor looks like. And I thank you for, I'm doing my own plug here, coming to the South by Southwest Climate Tech Cocktails Happy Hour Startup Showcase, which we did. And you brought a prototype out, which was super cool. And it's like, you want to see the future? Right? Here's a reactor. Take a look. And I, you know, while you're drinking, I thought that was super cool. And I want to thank you for doing that. And yeah, you know, I wish everybody could see that.
I will say it was not intentional that it looks as cool as it does. The fact that it looks like something out of the Star Trek Enterprise is just like a happy accident. But I am very comfortable hamming that up.
Yeah.
If anyone listening is curious and you want to come by Syzygy's lab, we're pretty open. Find a way to hit us up, you know, and we have like a reactor museum where we actually have all the reactors since the first one we made. So you can see like, man, back in 2018, we made a reactor out of tinfoil at Home Depot parts. and dude, that thing kicked ass. Like it set world records. And we kept it, and it is in the reactor museum all the way up to the most recent one that looks like a flux capacitor or something.
And yeah, and you'll see some awesome art while you're at it.
Yeah, tons of awesome art all through the facility.
Awesome. And so we're getting to the rapid fire question portion of this lovely session. And speaking of startups and the startup showcase, what are three startups, or who are three startup founders that you absolutely love and you want everybody else to know about? It doesn't have to be three. It could be four. You know, we're not strict on that rule.
For me, I'd say there's a couple. First off, if you are into things like alternative materials like plant-based leather, you should definitely check out my buddy Zimri Henshaw at Bucha Bio. And so if you've ever drank kombucha, you'll know about like the kombucha SCOBY that's at the bottom of the bottle. They actually take that, they turn that into things like leather. You know, they're working on like different materials for like car seats and like hats and things like that. And really just like all around, you know, yeah. awesome team.
It's like meow, meow, meow. All of the Berkeley hippies are nodding in unison, taking notes. They're like, really? Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Hey, it's perfect. It's perfect. And then so the next one, Moji Karimi at Timvita Factory. So also in the bio route, they genetically engineer microbes to do different chemical reactions. So like take CO2 and turn it into sugar or fuel. Talking about like injecting microbes into old oil formations so that they can eat the oil and turn it into hydrogen, which can then be produced. I think they just got some money from United, where United's working with them to like make microbes that make sustainable aviation fuel. Moji's lab is actually like two blocks away from ours. Yeah, if you're ever in Houston, you should definitely hit up Moji. And if you aren't following him in Civita Factory, you should definitely follow them. Adam Barron's at Mori. Mori makes a type of coating for food. So like food waste is a huge problem in the world. They make this silk-based coating that you can like put on vegetables or different kinds of food to keep it from going bad.
It's kind of like Appeal.
Appeal, yes.
Right. Yeah.
And so Adam's just an amazing founder. And then finally, Natalie Goodman at Incentifind. They help connect businesses with their incentives. She's awesome. You know, she's always out there hustling. So
oh, she is, man. She is. I know Natalie. Natalie is amazing. She spoke at also at an eCapital summit some years ago.
And yeah, we actually met at that one.
Yeah, she was in ATI. She's always out there hustling, grinding. Like I think I saw Incentifind. Aren't they also, I think they're also now part of Greentown Labs Houston.
Yep.
As well, which is amazing. And Natalie's just a person where I'm like, you need to succeed. Like, I want to see you succeed. Right? So, yeah.
Super awesome. Oh, he is. You should catch up with her. They're killing it.
Really? Amazing. Yeah. I love to hear that.
And just shout out to Greentown. There's tons of great companies there. You know, Criterion Energy, you know, Varia and Anna Dye. Like, I could just go on and on and on.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, or alpha, as they'll say in the crypto world, I'm actually going to do a happy hour plus startup showcase at Greentown in Boston. That's going to be like, I think it's mid-August, which I'm really excited about. I actually did a summit with them when they opened up their new global center in Boston. And, you know, love what they do. And Emily Reichert, of course, is a badass superstar. And I'm super stoked to do that in Boston. And who knows, maybe they'll convince me to come to Houston.
You should. A lot happening out here too.
Okay. Okay. Well, maybe, you know, once you guys raise a new round, I'll hit you up to sponsor a happy hour with Greentown or something, you know, in Houston. And we'll bring all eyes on Houston.
Count me in. I'll bring the scotch.
Okay, perfect.
You bring the eyes, I'll bring the scotch.
Great. And so the second rapid fire question, what are three books that have greatly impacted the way that you think and approach the world?
I'd say first would be this book called Man's Search for Meaning by a gentleman, Viktor Frankl, who's like a psychotherapist, lived through the concentration camps, actually. You know, basically, if I were to sum that up, like what I've taken from that is like, you know, people, like the world, life can take everything from you, but it can't take how you choose to view your situation. Mm. And so like you always have a choice how you choose to like view your situation and like what kind of attitude you choose to bring to it. And so like my choice is that I'm going to choose to try and make the most out of whatever I get served up with. That book has helped me find that a lot. And then the next one is Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correct, but
it could be Hesse, who cares?
Yeah. Know? It's basically the story of like one of the first Buddhas. And yeah. I read this whenever I was younger, but I find myself thinking about it a lot. And like, basically, you know, the Buddha goes out to find himself and he does all these journeys and everything. And he eventually like, you know, just gives up and sits by the river. And he sits by the river for years and years and years and just learns to like sit there and listen and like be okay with what's happening around him. And like, I think about that sitting by the river a lot and just letting life happen around you instead of like fretting and trying to control everything so much.
Yeah. I'm a pretty consistent meditator. And oh, by the way, this book, I think, was also like one of Steve Jobs' top books as well that he would recommend to everybody. So, you know, you're in good company. And speaking of rivers and just, you know, kind of closing off your mind, I've taken up swimming again. Now I'm going back to the gym, you know, with, you know, whatever we are in COVID. But I'm like, I just got to go back. And I've taken up swimming again. And what a meditative process. Like, you know, there's no phone nearby to look at and you're just in the water. And so, you know, swim for 45 minutes and it's a really meditative process.
Yeah, I love it. I used to swim a lot whenever I was younger. I miss it. I don't think I've been since before COVID. Now I'm going to be thinking about that.
Yeah. You should.
The last one, I didn't have a third book, but I just love sci-fi. And so I could like just sit here and name all kinds of sci-fi books. Like, I don't know if anybody's read like We Are Bob series. Like, those are great. No. You know, there's this really interesting book called A Fire Among the Deep by Werner Vinge. It's got the most interesting alien creatures I've ever seen in fiction. Read this amazing book recently called... Oh man, A Memory Called Empire by Arkady Martin, who recently won the Hugo Award. You know, the Stone Sky trilogy by N.K. Jemisin. Like, man, I could just go on and on and on. If anyone needs any sci-fi recommendations, like, hit me up. I've got like a whole library. And I actually think that I learn more from those books than I do like self-help books.
Yeah. So you and Ryan Bethencourt should form a sci-fi book club. He's also very into sci-fi. I'll ping you about him later. He's also, again, like a sci-fi maniac. And any sci-fi shows that you recommend?
Oh, man, I watch a bunch. So like watching Halo right now, watching all the Star Trek shows like Discovery and Picard.
Yeah.
Also love like Mandalorian and all my Star Wars stuff. I'm trying to think if the Expanse is really good.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's one that like stands out. Oh, okay. So this one's a bit weird, great. But if you're into that kind of stuff, Raised by Wolves.
Raised by Wolves.
Yeah, it's an HBO show, and it's Ridley Scott. And it is Ridley Scott. It is like most weird and bizarre. It is
great.
You will either hate it or love it. But just like stick with it. Stick with it as long as you can. I am so hooked on that show. Like, I cannot wait until the next season is like a year out. And I don't know what I'm going to do with myself.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm going to watch after this. And that being said, are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave all of our listeners with?
If you watch Raised by Wolves, I need you to tell me what you think about it, because it is way out there, man. Now, final thoughts. I would say whenever I started this whole like fight on climate change, like my personal mission, it actually came from a place of desperation, like a cornered rat. Like, I don't know what to do. I want to be part of this battle. I want to try and make a positive change in the world. Since I've started, I've actually gained a lot of hope. And it's not hope through my own actions. It's actually hope through like what I see the community doing. Yeah. I see like an army of clean tech rising to meet this. I see, like, we could sit here and like talk about like whether or not, you know, hydrogen's overhyped or anything. But the truth is, people are putting serious money into this. You know, I do think that we are on the cusp of something really transformational. And I would tell everyone, like, this is going to be a rough decade. We're actually starting to orient on the right path. And there's a lot of work to do, but there is like an army rising to fight this battle. And I think that we can solve it.
Amen. And so, I love
thank
that.
You for giving me hope.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's a beautiful way to end it. And thank you so much for joining us on the show. And I can't wait to have you back on in a couple of years when you all are still crushing it.
Yeah, no problem at all. Yeah, we'd love to be on anytime you want to have us.
Great. All right. Well, have a great evening, and everybody have hope.
Thank you so much, Matt. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers. Thank you so much for listening. The resources that we mentioned and everything else we talked about, drink recipes, various people, companies, so on and so forth, will all be linked in the show notes on our Substack at climatetechcocktails.substack.com. If you want to write us, our email address is m@climatetechcocktails.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at @CT_cocktails and on Instagram, #climatetechcocktails. You can reach me personally by carrier pigeon or on my LinkedIn /Matthew J. Myers. Until next time, keep the dream alive and do your part to make the world a better place for 100% of humanity. And thanks for tuning in.